This call is being recorded.
Hi, Anne. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Hello. So glad you could be here today.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, it's just, this is the first installment in the Writing Women's Lives, Writing Out Loud Sisterhood interview series. And It's just such a treat to get to have you to be our lead-off author, writing memoir and writing past silence. And so for those of you who are listening, either here or if you're listening to the recording later, I'm your host, Marilyn Basquin, and I am just thrilled to have Anne Tanning here with us today to talk about her debut memoir, which is titled Dragonfly Notes on Distance and Loss. And Dragonfly Notes is a memoir about, distance and loss, as the subtitle says, but it's about Anne's trying to make sense of her mother's premature death after a routine medical procedure. And in this memoir, Anne draws on just an expanse of memory and artifacts from her mother's life. Her mother was someone who saved everything. And so she draws on a lot of pieces to piece together the hard truths about her own past and her mother's. And I love how Ryder, who's here with us today, I love how she put it, what she said about your book in a comment on the Writing Out Loud Sisterhood. Let me see where it is here. She said that Anne built a case. She was in the middle of reading the book, and she chimed into the post that was announcing your book, and she said she built a case of love and disdain for her mother, that universal theme we all go through at times, whether we have one or are one. And so Thank you, Ryder, for that comment that you had shared. So Anne is also the author of three previous titles, and those are fiction titles. One is called Super America, which won the 2006 Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction and was in New York Times Editor's Choice Selection. And she's also published a collection of stories called The Price of Eggs and a novel called Butter. But, the way I'd really like to introduce you, Anne, is through a story. For those who are gathered here or listening to the recording who are meeting you for the first time, I really want to share this story. And it's a story about the scarf that I'm wearing right now around my neck. It's a light blue cotton scarf, and it has a dragonfly pattern on it. And each dragonfly, like I sit at my desk and I stare at these dragonflies on this scarf, and each dragonfly has four wings. And each wing is made up of a different calico print. And when I have it wrapped around my neck, it just gives me this sense of like having a swarm of calico dragonflies around my neck, which really calls to mind, of course, if you've read the memoir, Anne's mom, who was a sewer and made things out of fabric. Anne gave me this scarf when she was here in my town not too long ago doing a reading at the University of Lynchburg. And that reading, Anne, by the way, was hands down one of the loveliest readings I've ever attended. And I've attended a lot of readings. And there's just, Anne brought some of her mother's treasures. You brought like her diary from 1959 and a page from her childhood scrapbook. I think there was even like a popsicle wrapper that you had in your bag of your mom's stuff.
There was like an old ice cream wrapper.
But it was just such a warm and generous reading and just such a reflection of who you are. And after the reading, so my husband Steve was there because he works at the University of Lynchburg. And so after the reading, Steve and I and our friend Wendy, who is actually Anne's close friend from graduate school, and as it turns out, years later, she's Steve's cousin, but she's the one who introduced us to Anne. So it's like this big family down here. But we went out for a drink afterwards, and we were sitting at a booth in a local pub, and Anne handed me and Steve each a present across the table, and my present was this dragonfly scarf. And after we opened our presents, I looked across the table at Anne, and, And I thanked her for the gift. I was just so moved that here she was coming to do a reading for us, and she would think to bring us gifts. And she lifted her hands up in the air, and she said, in this just this bubbly way, she said, "I love giving presents." And in that moment, because I'd read Dragonfly Notes, right, I had the sense that I was witnessing Anne in a moment of being her mother's daughter, in just the best sense of that phrase. For those of you who haven't had a chance yet to read Dragonfly Notes, Anne's mother loved giving gifts, and often homemade gifts. And I just had this, like, I felt like I was witnessing or experiencing a moment of, like, pure Anne-ness, you know, your joy of giving. And I half expected maybe a dragonfly would land on the table. It was just such a magical little moment. So, and that's how I wanted people to meet you as well, to see that side of you that's just such a so fun to be with, and so giving. And so on that
I just want to say thank you, because as I'm sitting here, what a great connection to my mom. There's things that I would never even have thought of that is like my mom. And as I'm talking to you, I have this really cool black and white picture of her right in front of me. So I feel like we're kind of all doing this together. It's really cool. She always is at my desk in this favorite picture I have of hers, but I just sort of pulled it a little closer. So that
wonderful.
I feel like she's in on it with us. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's way cool. I'm so glad. Well, I always think of her with the scarf too. But what I'm thinking, a place to start talking about Dragonfly Notes. I mean, we are, because we're talking about your mom, who's really so central to this story. But I'd love to start on dragonflies. The first mm-hmm. sentence of the book, that first sentence: "My mother appears regularly to me in the form of a dragonfly, or so I like to think." And so I'm wondering, for those who haven't yet read the book, if you, Anne, wouldn't mind giving us a little thumbnail of the role dragonflies play in the story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if dragonflies planted the seed for the book, or did you start to write the book and then dragonflies emerged as like a central motif, or how, you know, just anything you want to tell us about dragonflies mm-hmm. and the writing of this memoir.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. So, you know, they did, after my mom died, it was very, you know, we were in the hospital for a long traumatic time. And so when I finally made my way back to New York, the dragonflies appeared, you know, they just appeared. And I know we all have our little talismans of, I know, people who have lost loved ones. You know, I have a friend who it's butterflies. I have a friend who, actually, a woman I met at a book reading said, for my mom, it's pennies. I find pennies all over the place. Hmm. And I thought, how cool is that? I've never heard of a non-creature kind of a thing like that. Like, that she just feels like her mom leaves pennies for her. And I tend to be a very realistic, practical person. And I usually don't buy into stuff like that. But I think when you lose somebody so traumatically, too, you become really porous and open and look, you know, open to any way that you might be able to make sense of what just happened in this loss. So they started appearing and I started noticing them. And, you know, one of the things, I started researching them as I started to write the book. I didn't start to write the book till about 2 years after my mom died, because I was so, you know, stunted and stunned and confused. But anyway, as I started writing the book, it began with Dragonfly Notes, and I started with the title. I knew it was going to be Dragonfly Notes.
Ah.
It never changed. Never changed from day one. 8 years ago, that was the title, and it still is. And I started researching them, and I found out that dragonflies live most of their lives underwater as green, ugly little, you know, nymphs. They're not colorful. They're very, you know, they're like worker bees. They're just down there doing their thing. Nobody sees them. And then when we see them out in the world in all their splendor and their beauty and grace, they're dying. They're usually alive for 2 to 3 weeks when we see them. And in fact, many of them that you see may die that day or the next day. So that to me really hit a note of, you know, it's the fleetingness of life. It's live in all your splendor every day that you can. And so I really latched on to that. And I do have a lot of cool dragonfly stuff now, I have to say, and every time I get something, it means the world to me. So, you know, little earrings or what have you. I actually make some dragonfly things too. So to me, that was, it is a visit. I think right after somebody dies, you get a little bit more visits like that. And then as time goes on, they're less frequent, but they still happen. And you just have to be, you just have to be awake enough to see them. So that's how that started.
Nice. And do you still get visits? I know this, this was a while ago that your mom died, and it's been a while.
Yeah. You know, I do. And sometimes it's weird because with all the research I did on dragonflies, they really only are on, you know, fresh standing water most of the time. You know, they're not typically by oceans or out in the middle of a dry field or something, you know, they're, and so a lot of times they come in very unlikely times and places. So I do still get them. I do still get visits. Yeah, it's really cool.
Nice. Awesome. Well, you know, I know Dragonfly Notes, you know, as I said in the introduction, it's not your first book. You've published works of book length works of fiction before. And so, you know, I thought I'd ask the question, you know, what went into your decision to write Dragonfly Notes as a memoir, given that you are someone who has a background in fiction?
Yeah, it's funny because I had, after my first three books, you know, I had children, I was living here, and I started writing really short essays, the kind that you would publish in this online magazine called Brevity or other places. And I really, you know, because I wanted to write about my kids and I wanted to write about how it is to live so far away from family, especially as a mother myself. I always thought, oh, the farther away, the better, the more adventure, the better. And then as I had kids, I sort of ached longingly for how far away my mom was, you know, that I wanted her to know my kids. I wanted her to see me with my kids. I wanted my kids to know her and sew with her and make little, you know, see how cool and interesting of a person and creative she was. So that really started me on brief nonfiction writing. And then after this, we were living in Vietnam right before my mother died with our kids on a Fulbright fellowship, my husband. And I was there actually to work on a memoir I called Viet Mom, M-O-M. And I wanted it to be about, like, what does a professional person with a career do who just decides to go be a full-time mom in Vietnam? That was what my whole thinking was. And it was about gender, both here and over there, and gender roles and so on. And I did finish that memoir. And then the day after I got home, my mother was, I never got to see her again. And I was in the ICU with her, you know, for a month. So I airlifted some of that memoir eventually into Dragonfly Notes. So the Vietnam scenes come from an entirely different manuscript I did write. And I didn't want to keep working on Vietnam because my concerns had shifted so greatly to what had happened to my mom. So that's how I started going into nonfiction. And in a weird way, it feels like this is my first book of me as a new kind of writer. Like, I don't know how to explain it other than this feels like the most important book I've ever had to write, or that I ever needed to write this book. That's what it was.
Oh, I love how you use the word needed. So many women that find their way to writing women's lives or in the Writing Out Loud sisterhood will say, you know, I mean, I've heard things like, you know, just someone who never finished high school saying, I never write, but I have to write this book. There's a need in me to write this story. And I wonder if that's just, you know, something that memoir, you know, that's why people find their way to memoir, is those stories that, that have to be told.
Yeah. And I had found all these, that's another reason why I wrote it, the memoir, is after she died, I mean, because she was such a saver, I like to call her an archivist of our lives.
That.
I inherited those archives, quote unquote, and I found so many things that she had written. I found out she'd published a sonnet and never told me. Just all these things and the many objects and recipe boxes and things that I started to piece together about her. Some many things I didn't know, dreams that she had had, successes she had had. She never did go to college, and she should have. She's one of the smartest people I knew. And I thought, I need to start. I did it through objects, but I need to start writing this, figuring this out. Like I need, and then I really wanted to hear her voice. And then there was the medical end of it too. Her death was so confusing and full of mishaps in the medical world that I had to go through those files too. I really, because when it happens, you're in such a state of trauma and shock. You don't know what's going on. So it took me a couple of years to really read through and dig through all her Rubbermaids full of stuff. And then I was like, okay, I have a book here. This needs to be a whole book, not an essay. It's a book. So that's how I got into the memoir. And now I'm so smitten with memoir. I'm on work on another one already. So I think, and the response I get different from, I mean, I published 3 books and I've never had the kind of, like almost every week I get either a little note from somebody or a gift or an email or something of how it connects to them. And that's just something you don't get in fiction. Like I have not ever had that kind of response to my 3 other books.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean, I had good responses, but not like this intense personal need to, like people just want to say something to me about it. And I'm so grateful when they do. And they're like, this could have been me, or this is me, this is my life. And I'm like, oh, I know. I get it. You know, we're all in this together.
Mm. And what a testimony to, you know, to your writing, the phrase that comes to mind, you know, writing past silences, writing to those places where people can, it resonates with other people because you do get below to the deeper universal truth of your experience and what it means in this case to loss and grief and, you know, looking into the story of your family and your mother. And it's really interesting to me that's such a different reaction to memoir and to fiction.
It's amazing.
Well, you know, and you know, you mentioned all of the artifacts, the archives that were bequeathed to you. And one of the many things that I love about Dragonfly Notes is the way that your mother's voice is woven in. You know, there's, a diary entry from, I think if I'm remembering correctly, from when she was young, like 14, there's letters, there's the sonnet that you mentioned. And, you know, and I know when you were here at University of Lynchburg giving a reading, you had said to the students there that one of the reasons you wrote it was to give your mom voice, which the memoir does beautifully. You know, one question I had, I'm just so curious, is, you know, to what extent did writing this memoir and giving voice to your mother, telling her story so that she would be heard, you know, to what extent did that help you to understand her life in a way you hadn't before? And to what extent did it help you to understand your own life in a way that you may not have had you not gone down this journey that led to?
That was my whole experience with doing this book. There, you know, my mom was a cleaning lady. She was at one point on welfare. She always had people calling her to pay her bill, collection agencies, right? So she suffered a lot of shame of that poverty and this embarrassment about that she couldn't. And I think that's why she was so gifted. She would always make sure we were very well dressed, even if she had to make it herself. It was these gorgeous clothes, gorgeous quilts, you know, really nice hair braided all the time. She was very concerned that we look nice and not think anything badly of us. But she just did not have any agency in her life. She didn't have any resources. She had a strong group of female relatives and friends. She always has had that. And I do think that's what got her through a lot. But in terms of living with, you know, an alcoholic and an addict, and in the time era, she got married in 63, she just really got into the wrong life that she should. I mean, she could have so flourished in so many ways. So, and then at the end, you know, I always, my whole life, I always knew I wanted to be a writer. And I would always ask her, well, Mom, what was it like? Like, why did you marry Hermer? When did, you know, didn't you see he was already an addict? And she'd say, oh, Annie, I don't want to talk about that. That's the, those are the dark times in my life. Let's just go make some cookies or something, you know. She did not want to go there. And I think that's another reason why writing the book felt, even though it was the hardest thing I've ever done, felt good, because she had resigned herself to so much at the end in the last decades of her life. This is just what it is. I'm not going to ever have a nice car. You know, I'm not going to whatever. And she, I don't know, I really wanted to show the complexities of her and that she was a very interesting person, you know, that she had a lot more going on than I think surely my dad ever gave her credit for. There's a scene in the book where I meet her. I'm at a conference in Kansas City and I sponsor her to come. I'm like, please come. It'll be so fun. And she really reluctantly does. And we went to, I took her to a jazz club and she's like, you know, your father says I don't even like jazz. She said, what does he know about me? You know, so she had all these parts of her. She was actually, for a small town Minnesota girl who never really left her hometown, she loved to travel. She came and visited us in Hawaii and was always game for anything. So I wanted to show that even though she had lived this really tough life, she deserved so much more. She really did find her own ways, but not enough people knew about it, I think. And I really wanted to highlight her complexities. And again, not just in a positive way, because I always tell my students, I can't provide this glowing, beautiful memorial to my mom, because she, you know, she had her flaws too. And I had to show that stuff too. And she and I really went head to head about a lot. I think she just wished I would just stay near Minnesota. And I never could manage to do that after I grew up. You know, I just think she longed for me there, because I think we really had a good connection. So it was in a way like a giving back of that too. Like, here's your story, Mom. And I know I was away so much of your life, but I'm here. We're still here. You know, we're still together. So.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but the other part on my life is that I didn't realize how much we were alike. And I suppose everybody says that when they get older about your mom. But I think, wait a minute, I always thought, well, you know, she never went to college. She wasn't very ambitious. I was always like, I'm going to go out and be an actress and a writer, and I'm going to college, and I'm going to get a PhD. And I never really thought much about her and what her dreams and goals really were. I just thought, oh, she's a really good quilter, and she can sew anything. But when I look at the kind of ways she transformed things, just a simple piece of cloth or, you know, these curtains she'd make, or knitting everybody's slippers that she knew, I feel like I'm doing that. You know, I'm trying to do that. And I, like you were saying about giving gifts, my mom always taught me it's never wrong. You know, just give a gift, pass on a compliment, never hold back, because it means the world to people. Just do that. And I feel like by creating, and for me it's writing, because that's the big skill, the only real skill I have. Unlike her, she could do a lot. So I feel like I wish I could have her back to tell her, Mom, now I get it. I just thought we were like, you were this small town homemakery, you know, person who just liked to sew. And she had so many dreams that I think were pretty much like mine. And I just never really saw that in her. And so it really made me grateful for her, that she kind of, maybe she offered that to me without even knowing she did. I'm pretty sure that's how it worked.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. What a gift to, for you, to receive from the act of writing this book, you know, putting into it what you put into it, to come out with that, that larger view, or that deeper heart, or that, you know, broader understanding. Even though, as you said, you know, another thing you do so well is draw out the complexities, as you said, and not just of your mom either. I mean, there's so many sides of her. You know, I mean, there's times mm-hmm. where I'm not, you know, I can't do the Minnesota accent, but where you quote her so well, saying things like, "You damn kids, you know, do you really think, you know," she's about to like throw a dish across the room, you know, the kitchen, you know, like mm-hmm. "Your father's out and he doesn't know that I'm here dealing with you guys," you know. It was her version mm-hmm. of that. I'm totally butchering her words and her way of speaking, but
no, it's but, true. Know. And you know, you could critique her and say, "Well, she shouldn't have, like, you know, she pulled us in a lot to try to help, like especially mm-hmm. me, because I was always a listener. So should I leave your dad? Should I not?" And of course, that probably wasn't a great idea. But you know, I wouldn't do that to my kids ever. But so there were things, you know, that I think she was just desperate. She just got desperate and either took it out on us or leaned on us way too hard for it. So as a result, I think all of us kids never felt like we really had a childhood. We were always sort of deeply in the trenches of trying to make our mom's life better and get our dad to straighten up, you know, so.
Well, and I can't help but wonder if just the fact that you went there, you know, and you did, you know, your mom was someone who didn't want the world to know that, right? She wanted the braids mm-hmm. to look well. She wanted the clothes to look well. And the fact that as a writer on the page writing a memoir, you were willing to go to the truth and be honest. I can't help but wonder if that's where people are coming up to you and saying, "Thank you for writing this. You really spoke mm-hmm. to me," you know, because it's when we do share the harder truths. Mm-hmm. that it resonates so much with others. And you know, so many women in the Writing Out Loud sisterhood community are, I like to say, you know, that we're a community of women who are done with silence. And I know many of the women in this community, some who are here today and others will be listening to the recording. I know that one of the things that we're doing is writing past silences. You mentioned your mother's, you know, the shame, and so often mm-hmm. shame is right there at the mm-hmm. heart of silence, right? Because it keeps us quiet. So many women in this community are writing past silence, and I imagine that you know the challenges that go into that. No matter what the silences mm-hmm. are that you're breaking, there's a variety of them, and so I'm wondering if you can talk about the silences that you found you had to write past in order to be true to this story. You know, the parts of your memoir that I guess I would say for the sake of being honest to the story, mm-hmm. I like to say, you know, the Patricia Hampel thing to the story that wants to be told, you know, mm-hmm. were there things that required more of you than you thought you could give at any particular time?
Oh, definitely. Writing. And I want to say one of the other thing, in addition to the poverty and stuff, which was all a byproduct of my dad's addiction, right, was
right.
that he was, because he was an addict, and addicts are charming and stubborn and, you know, selfish and whatever, he was very emotionally and verbally abusive to her. God help us, he never was physically abusive to her. I don't think he ever was. But because he was one of those kind of sloppy drunks, he wouldn't get drunk and get angry. He'd get drunk and get, you know. So, but he, I have heard my whole life him emotionally berate her and verbally berate her, both in front of others. And, you know, this kind of, he was very controlling about things and would, like, if she had a good time with something, he'd sort of make her pay for that. Whether by him ignoring her or not talking to her or whatever it was. And so that was really something I learned, you know, as a girl and as a person who later went into my own relationships. I had, of course, a nice series of super bad boyfriends, you know, really most addicts, unreliable, no job. I mean, it was just completely my dad. And so when I was doing this book, it had so many different drafts, of course, over 8 years. But I think the thing that was the toughest was how much to implicate my dad. Because he really did, however you want to look at addiction, and I do think it's a disease, And the relapse rates are huge, that even when you do get sober, which he did, he relapsed and then he went to a different addiction, different drug. It's really hard to put things down like that in a book and say, yeah, you really screwed up, you know, without casting blame. But then my question was always, well, there was blame. This was, you know, and then I guess why my question of the book was, for why did my mom stay with him? Why? It really seemed to never get better, right? It never changed. And she stuck it out all those years. And I felt a little weird. I will say this, for people who have not read the book, there's a section in it called Post-it Apologies. And I found in my mom's stash, these are things she saved, all these little weird handwritten notes my dad would write to her. And they were always apologies for not being a good husband and not being around and not listening to her and not whatever. And that was the one moral quandary I still feel to this day is, was that really mine to publish in this book? Those were between those two. He wrote those to her, right? And then she saved them. But then they landed in my hands. And I lived that world with them. But I think that was really a hard one for me. Because did I have a right to that? I still kind of think about that sometimes.
Well, I know so many of us, you know, at some point when we're writing memoir, I think it's inevitable, right, that we're going to come up against, you know, the family thing. You know, what's the family going to think? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the questions that a student asked you at your reading when you were here at the University of Lynchburg was the question, how did writing this memoir change your relationship with your siblings? And at the mm-hmm. moment of the asking, I was in the audience and I kind of had a sort of a chill go up my spine because you had just told me what was happening in your family with your siblings. I mean, the book had just been published. You had just at that time into Minnesota to do several readings. And, if you would share with us, you know, what the fallout was for you, I thought it was such that question, like almost like that student had been planted in the audience, right? I mean, the way that we just sniff out each other's vulnerabilities, right? Because here you were in the moment. But you had... Part of your answer and it was a metaphor, and this is all I'm going to say, and then I will be quiet and let you answer. But it was just the brilliant metaphor of, you know, you said, you talked about your sister Amy and her reaction and how she's now, you know, we know from the book and from what you've just said in this conversation, the circumstances of the way your family grew up in poverty and often in a trailer, and your sister now lives in a subdivision where there's, I want to say you said there's an ordinance that you keep your garage doors open. And you said, you know, this memoir was like me, it was such Anne's style. This memoir was like me not only opening the garage door, but having the yard sale.
That's right. No, that I do honestly think, that came off the top of my head when that student asked me that. But now, in retrospect, I think that is the strongest metaphor for what has happened with my family with this book. Because I told, you know, I told a whole bunch of stuff about our family. So I will just say that my sister has not spoken to me since the book. I'm getting this book, if you hear me moving around, there's a book called Family Trouble, Memoirists on the Hazards and Rewards of Revealing Family. Do you know that book? Oh my God.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's such a great, it's kind of been my, you know, my comfort during this rough time. But anyway, after the book came out and when I arrived in Minnesota, which was really just weeks after the book came out, my sister wouldn't speak to me and just texted and said, I can't come to any of this. I can't support your book. And I, you know, all the people who read it were like, what has her so upset? She comes off so well in the book. And, you know, she doesn't, you know, seem like that. And I thought, you know what, really, yeah, I went through the book a million times trying to not put in anything that would embarrass her personally or make her look bad. And I think, you know, that metaphor you were talking about, Amy has transcended her class of being, you know, poverty level, as have I, but Amy's done it in a way that is very, very conscious of what other people think. So they live in a very small town. Her husband's a banker, and the last thing they want to do is for anybody to see any of their rough edges, you know, in the past. So by writing the book, I was opening their garage doors. There is a covenant that you're not supposed to do that, leave your doors open, garage doors open, because you could see the junk, right? You don't want people to see all your junk. You're supposed to keep a nice appearance. So that was really painful, and I was really thrown off because I was just about to go do my first reading from the book in my home state, you know, and I get this message from her that she just can't even do it. And I wrote back and I said, I want to talk to you. Let's not text. And she said, no, not ready for that. So it's been 2 months and she's still not speaking to me. And she got my brother also not to go to anything and not to speak to me also. We're not speaking. And those are the only two family members I have left. And the only thing I can think is that they don't want anybody to know, you know, how poor we were or how bad Dad was, or, you know, they like happiness stuff. They like to think of the good stuff. But Amy always says, why don't we just remember the good things instead of always focusing on the bad? And of course, since I'm a memoirist now, I'm a backward looker. I'm trying to figure out how we are now from what happened in the past. I think that's what every memoirist is really kind of trying to do. She also wrote, I guess, to all my cousins and relatives before I came and said, you should really reconsider supporting Anne on this book because she's more concerned about fame than family. And that really struck me because, as we all know, you're not famous. As a writer, especially one who publishes with small presses and, you know, and I thought, what an odd thing that she thinks I'm worried about fame, which is obviously the last concern on my mind with this book. I just think that as a writer, with fiction it was okay because I could hide, even if it was ever semi-autobiographical, but this is just opening it up. She did say, and I think this is a fair thing for all of us to consider who write in this genre, you've been working through all of this whole time you've written the book. I'm just seeing it now. And I thought, well, that's fair. And I even told her way before the book came out, I said, I don't expect you to do cartwheels over reading this grief memoir of our mom's horrible death. You know, but I said, and I do understand that. That's going to be tough for you. But somebody once told me, as long as you're writing with love and you're not trying to get someone, you know, like I'm going to lay the record straight here. I'm going to get him for what he did, or I'm going to tell her. Everybody needs to know what an awful person she is. You should be okay as long as you're writing with love. And that's truly what I tried to do. And I do think I did that. And, you know, I know it's hard for her. I know she read the book because she texted me every few seconds to tell me something she didn't like as she was reading it, or something that she didn't think I had considered well or whatever. But the silence is hard, and I think the silence just needs to be silence for now between us, because I'm not ready to. With the reaction I've had from other people in this book, I'm just not ready. I don't feel like I really need to apologize for anything. So I'm just going to try to ride it out and get the love other places, because there's a lot of love.
Yes. Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Anne. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I once heard, similar to what you just said, I once heard Sue Silverman say something very similar along the lines of love, and then she said that for her, the way she deals with it is she tells herself, you know, if the person who's, you know, rejecting me as a result of something I've written does that, then we probably didn't have the relationship in the first place that I want to have. And I'm not saying that that's, I'm not at all giving advice for your relationship with your sister, no way.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to share that perspective that she shared that, because I thought of it a lot, you know, that a memoir can really bring to the surface to relate, you know, relationships, like what's happening in real-time relationships.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I would completely agree with that. We've always had, we're just such different people. You know, we vote for different political, I'm not going to say much more than we vote for different political candidates. One of us loves to travel, one doesn't. One of us, you know, like, I don't really care what people think anymore. I don't know that I ever, I know I did as a littler kid, but that is not my main worry in life, is what are other people in this town thinking of me? And, you know, she didn't go to college. Nobody else in my family went to college. And I just think that there's these alienating rifts from between us that have always been there, always. Mm-hmm. So this, it isn't new or startling, but the vehemence and utter shutdown was a lot more than I thought would happen. So we're also a very stubborn family, so I don't know. My whole thing is just to stay quiet and listen to the silence and try to, it's a very Buddhist, just sit in the discomfort of this and just try to be in it and not solve it right now. I don't have the tools to solve it. So I'm just trying to be in it, hope for the best. I don't know. Just, you know, be in the present moment and enjoy when I get beautiful messages from people and hugs and cards and things.
Nice. Well, you know, I'm looking at our time, and I would love to give people a chance for questions. But before we turn to that, I'd love to just give everyone an opportunity to hear you read from this book. And there's a passage that from a vignette in the book called The Dream House. There's a passage that it really, I think, does go to the heart of giving your mother voice in the ways in which she wasn't able to have her own voice while she was here. And so I wondered if you would share that with us. It starts at the bottom of 158, begins the scrapbook with all the artfully furnished home interiors, and then it goes to the end of the chapter.
Okay, absolutely. It's a little bit called Dream House, and it was found, you know, it was again more found objects that I found this thing. She had pasted all these beautiful little dream homes and furniture and things. So I'll read from the section you mentioned there. The scrapbook with all the artfully furnished home interiors had been left unfinished. In fact, after the first 9 or 10 pages, it was empty. It struck me now how soon the tapering off of the furniture ads must have begun. How quickly the dreaming must have subsided. How long did it take, I wondered, for my father's alcoholism to end up costing them everything? They'd married in October of 1963. How long was it before she realized she'd never get that Mayfair pink electric oven? November? December? How long before she knew it was best not to keep compiling ads for a lovely life she would never inhabit? If I could have my mother back for just one day, I would ask her these questions and beg her to answer them. Please tell me, I'd ask her over a cup of coffee on her front porch, why did you marry him? You were so smart and pretty and talented. You must have had some idea what you were getting into, didn't you? Did you really love him that much? As I leafed through the mostly empty pages, I found a smattering of magazine clippings in the very back. An afterthought? A later burst of hope? There was a small article pasted among them, 5 good tips on using color in your home. These weren't ads, but fully realized and highly idealized photographs of elegantly groomed women showing off their emerald and coral bedroom linens in pristine, well-lit rooms. One photograph struck me with its simplicity, a beautiful open staircase with holly wrapped around the banister, and a small table festooned with Christmas gifts. It looked almost exactly like the front staircase in my own living room, right down to the holly and the Christmas gifts. The final clipping was a country blue kitchen with a maple table and chairs set perfectly with orange and yellow napkins, placemats, and plates. The yellow checked curtains coordinated with the dinnerware, as did the seat cushions. The table overlooked a large picture window with a view of a sprawling yard and an oak tree. I like to imagine my family sitting around that table. Me as a kid swinging my feet back and forth, Amy, Jim, and Mike asking politely for more mashed potatoes and gravy, my father in a shirt and tie slicing into his steak with a fork and knife. Buzzing around the table in all her domestic glory would be my mother, filling our glasses with milk, asking if everything was all right before carefully removing her floral apron, folding it over the back of her chair, then settling down in her pink shirtwaist dress and pearls as she served herself a modest portion of green peas, then beamed at her gorgeous and well-kept family. Instead, my mother served frozen pizza for dinner, which we ate right off the box, two small ones for six people. We lived in the trailer court at the edge of town, and our backyard was the town cemetery, which became our playground. We'd run wild while our parents were at work and ride the gravestones like rocking horses. In winter, you could hear ice and snow tick against the trailer's metal exterior. And more than once, during summer tornado warnings, my mother would rush us down toward the cemetery to hide behind those same gravestones for safety, since we had no basement. The things I always dreamed of and wished for that we never had in the long, skinny trailer: windowsills or a telephone. This telephone we simply couldn't afford, and instead of real windowsills, nice deep wooden ones on which I could set precious moment statuettes or spider plants or stacks of books, we had little strips of metal around crank open windows. The house was, after all, meant to be mobile, a fact my mother hated, but which she tried desperately not to say out loud.
Wow, thank you for sharing that and for reading for us. Is there anything that you want to say about what you just read before we turn to questions? Or anything
that,
else you'd like to say
yeah.
at all?
No, I think I'm good. That section, I've never read that section before, and you made me think that might not be a bad section to read, you know? At a reading or something, because I had forgotten there is a lot about the trailer court in the book. So just thank you for reminding me of that section.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I will invite people now. If you want to ask a question, just let me know in the chat box, and I will unmute your line. I find that to be the funniest term, muting and unmuting people when we're talking about writing past silence. But just let me know in the chat box if you have a question, and I am happy to open your line so that you can ask Anne yourself. And if for any reason you want to just type your question in the chat box and have me read it to you, that is fine too. And while you are letting me know in the chat box, I'm going to go ahead and start with a question, Anne, that came in from someone in the Writing Out Loud Sisterhood Facebook group who was not able to be here live, but she wanted me to ask you this question. And we didn't really get to talk too much about structure yet, so that this question goes straight to that. Okay. And for those of you listening, the book is written in it's three braids, and it's written in what we might call vignettes or fragments, pieces that are then pieced together. And so this question is from Michelle, and she says, I love the way Anne's book is put together, almost like vignettes, but they work so well as a whole. I'm interested in how she decided to order them and what considerations she took into account in that process. Did she write them out of order? That sort of thing. So anything you can say to us about that?
Yeah, structure was a really big deal with this book because, you know, I knew it wasn't going to be a kind of a chronological book because there was just too much going on. There were too many things going on. And what really helped me finalize those braids was after I finally got the energy or what have you to really look into the medical stuff, I knew that I could have a strong, solid bunch of info and stuff about that because that was obviously the most intense. you know, the what happened, the medical procedures she had, what were the problems with it, how did it affect her, and then all the hospital scenes. But because I also know that's really heavy material, I knew readers needed some breathing room. Like there had to be other parts. So then I started writing these little dragonfly pieces. So that was kind of the second thing. And I, at first I just had a few. And then I thought, well, what else is this book really about? And I kept looking at all her stuff, you know, that I had inherited of hers. So that became the other strand, which was, who was my mom before? Who really was she based on all these artifacts? And then I thought, well, that's just it. I'm not in it. Like, how do I connect to her? And any, it's not a biography. So then I thought, well, I need to put like me and my life. And that's really the distance part on distance and loss, the subtitle. How, why did I go? Why did I stay away? What is the cost of that distance? You know, and what is the, how is it for me to be a mother too? And I'm writing about her as a mother and myself as a mother. Like, I think that you said Ryder had said something about that, whether we have one or are one. So then I sent it to the editor and he said, well, you need more of those dragonfly things for structure. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, but I don't want to be cheesy about it. And he said, no, you just do. He said, it's, and then I totally agreed because it's breathing room. It's lighter, it's prettier, you know, than death. So, and then I just put them all across the floor. There's 35 sections in the book and I laid them all across the floor and I've had them in every order imaginable. And I decided the only thing that really stayed the same was the first section. This is actually where I started. My mother appears to me regularly in the form of a dragonfly, or so I like to think. I felt like because the dragonfly structure was going to be prominent, I had to at least introduce the readers right away to that so it would make sense. So right. It was like, I do say it was like making a quilt. It really was like I had all these pieces and I had to make them together in patterns, you know. It's weird. It was hard.
Mm-hmm. And so you didn't stick with just one strand at a time. You did. You bounced around
No. And
wrote pieces. Yeah, yeah.
No, because some of the,
at the end.
Yeah, the other thing was that Viet Mom memoir I was talking about. I did took that out and incorporated and kind of, what do you call it, updated some of that to use in this book. So that was a little, you know, a little tricky, but it needed to be in there and I thought that would work. So I never had the three strands at the beginning. I thought this is about my mom's death. That's all I had at first. And then it became those three little sort of colorations of what surrounded that.
Nice. That reminds me of the Anne Lamott, you know, you take the Polaroid and slowly things start to come into focus.
Mm-hmm.
As
yes.
you look at it. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for answering that, Anne. I see that Debbie has a question. So let me come to your line, Debbie, and I'm going to open your line. Let's see if I've... Can you,
Hi.
I think you're on mute. Hi, Debbie.
Hi there.
Hi.
I actually typed my question into the text box there. But this has just been wonderful, Anne. I just want to say thank you so much. So I'll just read my question. In
mm-hmm.
five wallpapers, short sections
mm-hmm.
of text are divided by the descriptions of the wallpaper fragments. This
mm-hmm.
seems like an example of how you wrote from object prompts, and I wondered if you could talk a little more about the that process of writing from objects.
Oh, yeah. So what did you say, how I put them together with the wallpapers? Or did you say object prompt?
Yeah, writing, because I think you mentioned earlier
mm-hmm.
about writing from objects.
Mm-hmm. I always write...
I was just going to say, Anne, I'm not sure if it was clear.
You know, all you have to do is, you just pull off something off your desk and you're like, oh, well, that's about, you know, you have a story with it. And then it keeps you, to me, that wallpaper, when it keeps you from abstraction, like that was such an emotional thing to see my parents' gutted sort of empty house now. And by keeping it on the wallpapers, I'm keeping it on a solid sensory footing the whole time. So I was trying to get at the deep depths and loss I felt about her house as a metaphor. But then paper was saying about my mom. She loved things really easy. And, you know, people tear off wallpaper when they get a house. My mom was always about wallpaper. It's thrift store. I was in this thrift store one day a couple years ago, and I saw a big log of not that cute wallpaper, but I bought it because I just thought, Mom. And, you know, I started looking at, what is it called, Google Earth, when you look at, like, I can look at my parents' house on the computer on Google Maps or Google Earth, and I just kept longing for that that house. And I would, you know, go through the rooms mentally in my mind and remember the wallpapers. And I just thought, well, I'm going to use that. I didn't know if I was going to have 5. I was going to have 10, I thought. But then it was too much. So then I just did 5 wallpapers. And I would always keep bringing it back to that one line, you know, white with cream-colored flowers and violets or whatever. So I think you can do anything with objects. You can write about anything you want, death, birth, food. All you have to do is just pluck an object out of your life and sit with it and look at it and write about it.
Mm. And Debbie, I did mute your line again just because Anne was talking and we were starting to get like a what sounded like an echoey blowback. So I did mute your line again, and so I'm going to read to Anne what you've written in the chat box. So in response to your answer, Anne, Debbie writes, I have done exactly the same thing with Google Earth to look at my childhood house. So
cool.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that we have that connection, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like the best we can do. It's home, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, and I actually did the same thing very recently with my grandparents' house in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't figure out how to use Google Earth. So, Debbie, you'll have to come over and show me how to use Google Earth at some point. That'd be great. But let's see. Lori also has a question, and so does Maggie. So what I'm going to do, and if you're able to stay for a couple more questions, it is
at
the hour now.
I'm fine.
That'd be great.
Yep. No, I'm totally good. I'm free.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to open Lori's line. And Lori, what we'll do is we'll just kind of play it by ear, and if the sound starts to get wonky, then what I'll do is mute myself first to see if you guys can stay with an open line, and we'll just wing it. So let me unmute Lori. Hi, Lori, your line is open.
Hi, thank you. That call dropped out, so I came back with another line. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
I'm really in love with this older piece you wrote, Remembering I Was Not There. And it's great. I loved it when Marilyn actually brought it into our class. And I see that it says it's from 1999.
Whoa. Yeah, I guess so.
So I haven't read your book yet, only the excerpt and the wallpaper piece. But I realized from just listening to you, a lot of the threads of your original thoughts go definitely all back there.
Absolutely. You're so right. Well, you know what's funny? That piece, Remembering I Was Not There, I did write, you know, a long time ago. And I remember at first, I was going to say I pretended it was fiction. I changed the names. I thought I was
going to ask
short
that
story.
Because it's hard to your family.
Yes.
And there's no way it reads fiction to me.
Right? But at that time, you know, I don't think creative nonfiction was as bold and as inventive as it is now. And so I thought, well, this isn't real. I obviously wasn't there before my parents got together. But then the more I thought about it, I never published that singly. It just went in the Norton anthology. I thought, well, it's all true. There's nothing about it that's not true except my conceit of me standing around and trying to tell them not to get married. So I thought this is absolutely nonfiction. But that was...
I think it's still bold today based on what you said about then. And I absolutely resonate with the piece. And I was wondering two things. Number one, where did you get that idea to do it that way? And the structure within here, how did you... Did it evolved? Did you have it in mind before you started? Because it's very complicated to study, but reads very simply.
Mm-hmm. You know what? There is, I remember I was looking at a picture of their wedding. I think it was a black and white picture of their wedding. But there's also this writer named Jane Ann Phillips. And she was originally from West Virginia, and she wrote this little piece called, I think it was called Wedding, or no, it's called Sweetheart. And it's her, you never see the photo, but it's a brief creative nonfiction piece. And she just kind of talks through the photo and what will happen, you know, what's really kind of going on in the background that she would later learn. And so I thought, I just didn't know how to do it. And I think, like I was saying before, by me thinking of it as fiction originally, I was protecting myself and maybe protecting my parents.
Maybe a little freer to say it that way.
Yeah. Like, oh, if I said their names and said it outright,
was your mom alive then?
She was. Yes.
And so, this was never shared then?
She never saw it because that was back when you could actually do that. We weren't really online much. I don't know. It was, she never, to my knowledge, saw that. Yeah. And I wonder what she would have thought. I don't know.
So did you have a sense of relief or guilt or both in the process?
I did not feel guilt. I felt like I was trying to offer another option or something, you know? Like, I feel like kids are so attuned to what's going on, no matter how little you are, that I really felt like I knew. It's so funny. As a child, I felt like I knew better. They just shouldn't be together. And so it sort of gave me, by using that device of pretending into the past, sort of like imagining the past, I guess.
So imagining then the structure, it's all in the past plus a non-existent past. And future.
Yeah.
How did you deal with that?
How did I deal with the
whole structure? How did you get that back and forth? Were you conscious of it or?
No, you know, I like to write in segments anyway. You know, I always just like little scene to little scene to little scene. So I remember, and if I'm, it's in past tense, right? If I'm remembering right, or is it God, I don't have it in front of me, but I remember thinking, I'm just going to pretend like this is actually happening.
Yes.
And I do remember my mom always me saying, well, what'd you do for your honeymoon? And she'd be like, oh, it was just the crappiest thing, you know? So I remember kind of translating their stories and letting that sort of be the guide. Like, here they go on a honeymoon. And then, oh my God, my dad got kicked off the baseball team. And here, you know, it was all these sort of, I want to say famous stories that everybody would always tell in the family. And I just kind of collected them together and said, don't do it, you guys. It's not going to work out.
Very cool.
But I recommend it. Yeah. I know some people use it to teach and have their students. I've seen a couple really cool things that students have done in the same, you know, as an exercise from this that are so cool. So maybe you have one in you that you are writing or you need to write.
Well, I feel that same way. I know I'm the keeper of the flame of all the stories. And yeah, you just put it in a wonderful pattern. But yeah, I loved it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. So nice.
Okay. Thank you, Lori. And as I was just listening to you answer that question, you know, it occurs to me that it sounds like that piece was quilted together, so to speak, as well, the way that you quilted together. And just for those of you listening, the piece that Lori and Anne were just talking about is a short piece of nonfiction that Anne wrote in the late 90s called Remembering I Was Not There, and it's collected in an anthology called In Brief. I want to say it's In Brief. Short takes on the personal, and the editor is Judith Kitchen, a wonderful collection of short memoir pieces. Okay, let's see. We have Maggie now. I'm going to open your line, Maggie, and we'll do the same thing. The sound stayed pretty good, so here we go. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Marilyn. Hi, Anne. Thanks for sharing your story with us. I want to go back to sort of your thought process in, I guess, ethical decisions memoir writers face. I know Mary Carr in The Art of Memoir says that sometimes she would let family members read an entire draft before she published it. Was that ever an option for you, or do you think it would be in future manuscripts?
You know, I will say this. I don't think I would do that. I think part of it is I don't think I would have any books if I did that. Because of the prior things, I don't know if you were listening before, but like with my sister and stuff, we're just different. I don't, you know, she isn't, I don't think she would ever like to, if it was up to her, she wouldn't want me to write another memoir. And so if I sent it to her, I'm not sure where that would leave us. And I've always heard from writers both sides of this coin. Some writers are like, oh my God, why would you do that? But then on the other side, you know, like Mary Carr, I love that book, by the way. I feel like if you do that, you have to be willing to change your book or pull it, possibly. Right. And for me, this is my survival. I mean, not financially, but this is the only thing I know how to do to get through the world as it is. So I feel like I want to say, contact my siblings constantly during the writing of this book. And I would say, where were we when mom, blah, blah, blah. Or do you remember in the hospital, you know, getting things right kind of stuff. But I think the issue for my family situation is far beyond getting accuracy. It's please don't tell our stories. So, and I think some writers I know consider it censorship. Like, do you want that?
Right.
And here I am with my siblings not talking to me. So I'm probably not, you know, I mean, maybe I should have, but I honestly don't think we would be sitting here talking about this book if I had. I think the problem was already deeply embedded. So what do you think about that? Like showing, would you show your family or?
Well, my dad has kind of given me the go. I'm trying to write a memoir about my dad. He's given me his blessing and go ahead. He said, I know that whatever you write, there's love there and you love me. Mm-hmm. So I feel good about writing about him. But I'll sort of poke and prod him and he'll say, well, you're asking me all these questions. And I should want to remember things, and there's things I need to forget. So I kind of have to piece together and imagine, or just sort of deduce based on the little scraps I have about, you know, things like abuse he faced or lack of love at home. And so I guess maybe I should ask him, are you okay with me piecing together your story to give you dignity and to still honor the pain, you know, that I know was passed down to me. So I think is ongoing.
Yes, that's good. It sounds like you're paying attention to all the right things. And I will say this, there's no way I would have published this if both my parents were alive. No way.
Right.
I wouldn't have written all of this stuff about my dad. I wouldn't have been comfortable doing that if he was still alive.
Yes.
So it really all transpired after the loss of them and the need to figure them out. And I do think there is a certain respect for, I mean, I'm not saying you have to wait till somebody dies, but at least with my parents, I couldn't have done it.
I will probably have to face that decision too. And
I'm
thinking about it now.
It's good. It is kind of interesting to talk to. It's a tough one, but it helps to run it by other writers, I think, you know, see what they do.
Well, thank you, Anne.
Well, thank you, Mighty.
Okay.
I had muted and just unmuted myself, so I'm assuming you can still hear me, Anne?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'm good.
Okay.
You're super. Doing a great job, by the way. This is an amazing bunch of balancing you're doing. I just want to say, wow.
Oh.
Good job.
Well, what a just what a treat to have you with us. And I don't see any more questions in the chat box. Let me just make sure there are no more. So, you know, and I okay, I think we've got it. Let me okay, so here's the way I thought we might close, Anne, and you might mm-hmm. just take back, you know, thinking that this was well done after I asked you to do this, and feel free to say no way. But I, you know, one of the many poignant moments in the memoir is one of the times that I got choked up was when your narrator, you know, your character herself, showed up in your mom's hospital room, and mm-hmm. you know, there was nothing you could do, right? And the one thing mm-hmm. you did do that did choke me up was you saying to your mom,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I think it was Dream a Little Dream, maybe, or Puff the Magic Dragon, maybe.
Puff,
but,
I think it was both of them.
Oh, okay. Well, and then when you were here for your reading here, you and Wendy. Do you remember this when we were at Isabella's at dinner before your reading, and you and Wendy just burst into song, and I got to hear you sing, and I sat there and I looked at Steve, and he looked at me, and later we were like, "Did you hear her voice?" And we were just, so I, you know, I just had this crazy idea if there's any way you would sing a little tune for us by way of closing, and not to put you on the spot, which I'm totally doing. And if you don't want to do that, we will still absolutely love and adore you and your voice. So
that's so funny, because here's the secret. I was in musical theater. I was a theater major. So I actually am not too super shy about doing it. Because you know what I mean? I in fact, in my office at school, one of my colleagues down the hall said, "I just love your singing." And I said, "What?" She said, "Oh, you're always singing. I love listening to you sing." I had no idea I was doing it. I said, "Oh, I should close my door."
Okay.
And she said, no, don't even be silly. So anyway, I guess I am always full of song. And when my mom was dying, you know, they say hearing's the last thing to go. Everybody always tells you that. So I was like, well, maybe I can pitch a little voice to her. So I will sing a little Puff the Magic Dragon. I think that one's pretty easy. And I actually did sing that to her.
Nice. Thank
Puff you. The Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff and brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Puff the Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu.
Oh, thank you, Anne. Thank you so much. That was absolutely beautiful. What a treat.
You're so sweet. That was really a sweet idea. Thank you. My mom would love that. And she would love you. She totally would love you.
Oh, well, I love her right back, and love you too, Anne, and just thank you so much for being with us, and it's just always just, you know, I feel like you're way closer than the miles between us, but...
I know, we've really bonded and become really close. I feel so lucky to have you.
Yeah, well, and
thank
you.
I want to say thanks to everybody, too, who is part of this group with you, amazing group of women, and you're lucky to have Marilyn and each other, and it's really an honor to be the first one on this particular show that you're doing, so I am so touched and honored that you asked me, so thank you very much to all of the cool, smart, powerful women in this group.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you, Anne. Well, you know, like attracts like. So here we are, all are together, right? So
mm-hmm.
Thank you. And
yep.
Thank you all. I second what Anne said. Thank you all who joined us here today live and took time to be here. I will see all of you in the Writing Out Loud Sisterhood. And thank you to those of you who are here by recording. So glad you could join us and be here in energy after the fact. So much love to everyone. Much love to you, Anne. And, you know, keep writing, everyone, writing past those silences. And we'll, you know, we do that together, really, is one of the ways that I have found to write past silence. So much love, everyone.
All right. Love to all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.